after a while their brain gets tired. So it's August 20th, 2010 in Slovenia, and we're going to be discussing how to appreciate devotees instead of offend them. So yesterday we talked about the six loving exchanges, how we have to establish our relationship with Krishna, and then we can have proper exchanges with devotees. The day before, we spoke about how our essential dharma is that of service, and when misused, we become the servant of the senses. And we talked about perverted... Anybody remember? It was 2 days ago. Rasa that we have with the senses. Do you remember? We were talking about having a rasa with a sweet ball. Everybody remember? So when you join the Hare Krishna movement, one of the first things you learn, hopefully, are the 10 offenses to chanting Hare Krishna. And we talk about the glories of the pure chanting of the holy name. Almost every initiation, Srila Prabhupada would discuss these 10 offenses to chanting. And there were certain offenses that Srila Prabhupada would say, this is the worst offense. Do you know which of the offenses Srila Prabhupada would say, this is the worst offense?
This number seven is the worst offense.
Sinning on the strength of chanting. What else? The first one, offending a Vaishnava. And the only other one I know he said that was disobeying the orders of the Guru, which we will look at tomorrow. But this offending a Vaishnava, I think that very much in ISKCON we emphasize that we shouldn't offend Vaishnavas. It's one of the main things that's drummed into your head. Right? We should chant Hare Krishna, follow the four regulative principles, be attentive in your chanting. By the way, we should be attentive in everything, not just chanting. Attentive chanting, attentive hearing, attentive taking prasadam. And really, not offending devotees is very much about being attentive in our service. Really being there. And it was so wonderful what Prahlada Nandamara said this morning about that our reason for being inattentive. What did he say was our reason for being inattentive? So nicely put. Surely you were all here this morning for that class. If you weren't, you missed. Well, I know what you said. If you didn't know what you said, then that would be really bad.
Because we want to be Krishna.
We want to be Krishna. Yes, what else? What other reasons did he give why we're inattentive? Attachment. We're in anxiety about past, present, and future. I don't like the present, right? Okay, I'm in anxiety how I failed to be God in the past, how I'm not being very good at being God in the present, and how I'm probably going to fail at being God in the future. So this is also really the cause of our... Okay, I've got one on this side, one on that side. Well, you can get one in front of me, one behind me. Thank you. Thank you very much. So this is really the root cause also of why we have difficulty being properly attentive in our dealings with the other devotees, and instead we offend them. So we discussed this point the other day, but I'm going to make the point again because it's a very important one, that if you love me, love my dog. You can't say, Krishna, I love you, but I'm going to offend your dear devotees. It just doesn't make any sense. A parent is much more attached to their children than to themselves. Much more. If you offend me, I'm not as worried as if you offend one of my children. If you tell me I'm ugly, oh well. If you tell me my daughter's ugly, I'll be very offended. If you tell me I'm stupid, if you tell me my son is stupid, I'll be offended. Much more serious. Yeah, I used to be a teacher of children for about 27 years in ISKCON. And it's a very difficult job, teaching other people's children, especially when you're all in the same community, and especially when you're teaching them during the morning program and all the parents are there watching you teach their children. I remember one instance during Japa, we would have a Japa session, and then the children would color pictures because they couldn't chant Japa for the whole time. Usually we'd have some Japa, then some slokas, then they'd have a little quiet playtime. So this one little boy was coloring a picture of Hanuman, and he had colored Hanuman's eyes completely black, like just colored the whole face completely black. And I said to him, oh my dear, we'll call him Krishna Das, oh my dear Krishna Das, I used to always use Krishna Das, and then we got a devotee in our community who got initiated as Krishna Das, so stuck. So anyway, this little boy we'll call Krishna Das. I said, this is not very good. If we want to really show devotion for Hanuman, then we should color his face a little differently. Let's do it like this, let's do it like this. So then his mother came over to me, right in the middle of the temple room, right in front of all the devotees. She started screaming at me. She said, are you saying my son has no bhakti? So, people are, they become almost crazy. And I know with my own child, in our school, he was with another teacher. And he came to complain to me about this teacher. I was the head of the school. So I went to the teacher and I was telling her, you said this, you said this. And finally she looked at me. She said, Urmila, you're being a mommy. And I went, oops. So I found over the years that when it comes to their children, parents are not rational. And this, of course, we even see this with Krishna. He says, Apichet Sutarataro. And the acharyas say Krishna is so overwhelmed with love for his devotees that he says, even if they do something abominable, they're still saintly. That's Krishna's love for his devotees. Krishna told Srivast Thakur, he said, even a dog in your house, even your maidservant, any connection they have with you, they're dear to me. Like Lord Nisingadev, he tells Prahlad, so many generations, I forget the number, either 14 or 21. So many generations in your family, past and present, because you've become a devotee. That's how much love. Of course, Prabhupada says in a purport there that each of us only knows maybe up to our great-grandfather or great-great-grandfather. So this must mean other incarnations, that our family members through many incarnations are delivered. Why? Because Krishna has so much affection for his devotee. As soon as you become his devotee, he wants to deliver your grandfather from 10 lifetimes ago. How much affection. And especially one that's dependent. And just like this little baby here, he's completely dependent on his mother. Without his parents, he can't get any food. He can't do anything. So the parents are going to be even more if you offend a little helpless baby like that than if you offend their 12-year-old child. So the devotee who's completely dependent on Krishna, Krishna gets, nobody should insult them, nobody should harm them. Of course, Krishna doesn't want any living entity. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu claims that all living entities are his servants. All living entities. Not that we should think, okay, well, I don't want to offend Srila Prabhupada, but I'll offend everybody else. Or I can offend you because, well, you're not really such a great devotee. Now, with her, she's advanced. I don't want to offend her. But her, I can say anything because I see so many faults in her. This mistake was made by Suruchi. You all know the story of Suruchi? So, right, stepmother Dhruvamaharaj. So, like in many royal families, there's envy over power. It's very common that in royal families that there'll be fighting and even murder to get the throne. Just like Kamsa, he imprisoned his own father. Or Kaikeyi, she banished her own stepson. So same thing, that Suruchi, She said, you cannot sit on your father's lap. You cannot get the throne. You have to take birth as my son. You have to worship Vishnu, die, and take birth as my son. Then you can get the throne. So then Dhruva Maharaj, he's in the forest. He's doing his tapasya, chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. And Lord Vishnu comes. And Lord Vishnu gives him several benedictions. You remember the benedictions he got?
One of them, he gave him that you'll be able to rule over this planet. I think it was for 40,000 years.
Something like that.
You'll become the king of the, you'll get your father's throne. Mm-hmm. You'll be able to sit on it.
You'll be able to sit on your father's throne.
And then afterwards you'll go to a you'll have your own Vaikuntha planet in the pole star.
And then what about with his with Saruchi and Uttama, Saruchi's son?
He told her that she was going to burn in a forest fire and he was going to get killed by the Yakshas.
Yes. He said, your stepbrother Uttama is going to get killed by Yakshas and your stepmother will go looking for him and she'll burn in a forest fire. Because Dhruva Maharaj had started his tapasya with some feeling of vengeance. He had some feeling of vengeance. And in that purport, Srila Prabhupada says something very astonishing. He says, if you serve a devotee without knowledge, you will get the good result. But if you offend a devotee, you do not know where you are going. Now, why is this so astonishing? When Saruchi offended Dhruva, at the time she committed the offense, what was his position?
Ordinary conditioned soul.
He was an ordinary conditioned soul. And even when he approached Vishnu as a neophyte. This is explained by Rupa Goswami when he's discussing Artha, Artati, why the reason people approach Krishna. You know, the four reasons people approach Krishna. They want material happiness or wealth. I haven't been able to get wealth by getting a college degree and working hard. Let me ask God. Or they want freedom from suffering. I have this disease. Chemotherapy hasn't worked. Let me go to God. Or they're just curious. I wonder what's going on. Who am I? Who's God? What's happening? Or they're already Brahman realized, like the four Kumaras. Or Sukadev Goswami, they already have knowledge and now they want to approach Krishna. So this Dhruva Maharaj wanted material happiness. Sakama devotee. He's going to Lord Vishnu, not out of love and devotion. He's going to Lord Vishnu. I want a kingdom. I'm just a little boy. I can't do it myself. Let me ask him to help me. So at the time that Saruchi offended him, he was an ordinary conditioned soul. After that, he started on the path of bhakti with material desires. He was a neophyte in bhakti. But still, it was considered an offense against a Vaishnava, so much so that both she and her son were destroyed. So, better to think everyone is a devotee. Better to think everyone is a devotee in terms of offense. Of course, we have to choose what level of devotee with whom we associate intimately. So the little bug crawling on the ground is also a devotee, but I don't invite them in for become my intimate friend. Right? In some temples, there's animals that are devotees. You know, this Jananda Maharaj compiled a book, Animals That Are Devotees. Wonderful book. We had one cat like this in a temple in America. He had belonged to one of the bhaktas before he joined. Bhakta Tom was the cat's name. And you know how cats usually clean themselves? He didn't do that, ever. He was always scruffy looking. And he would just sit outside the temple room all day. Especially Mangal Arti, he was always there, sitting outside the window. And he would listen to every Bhagavatam class. At the end, when they would ask for questions, he would be quiet the whole class. At the end, when you'd ask for questions, and he didn't eat ordinary cat food. He didn't chase creatures. He would only eat prasadam. And, of course, for cats, they have to eat meat. Their bodies are not designed to be vegetarians. A dog can be a vegetarian, not a cat. So he got very sick, and he eventually died. But he would only eat prasadam, and he would eat like a person. He would take the prasadam in his paw, and he wouldn't just put his mouth in the prasadam, and he would eat things that cats just don't eat. Watermelon, you know. He would eat strange things. But we still did not invite him into the temple room. That's my point. He had to sit outside the window. We didn't say, okay, now you can come in the temple room. So we may distinguish between devotees. Some devotees we may just respect from a distance. Right? Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in his Sharanagati, if someone's chanting the holy name, whether they're initiated or not, if they chant one time, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, oh, what a Vaishnava. What a Vaishnava. Krishna takes account. Just like yesterday, Madhyana Leela and I were talking and we mentioned Prema Gopi and she was walking past. Oh, did you say my name? She didn't hear anything else we said. You had this experience? A whole crowd of people are talking and you just hear and then someone says your name. Oh. So Krishna hears his name even if you are saying Sinarama. You're saying my name. So we offer respects to anyone who has said the name of God even one time. And we intimately associate with people who are strictly following the process, who are at our level. We serve those who are higher. But we don't offend anybody. It's not that those levels of association mean, okay, these people I can offend. I just serve the topmost devotee. I make friends with those like me and those who are below me I can offend. No, it doesn't say this anyplace. And we're going to go to even a stricter definition of who I cannot offend in a minute. But let's say we don't want to offend anyone. We want to be offenseless. Because Krishna loves all living entities. Somebody asked yesterday, I think, how do I know that God respects me? God respects all living entities. Krishna has utmost love and respect and consideration and understanding for every one of his living entities, for the little flower outside, for the blade of grass, even for the mosquito that's not letting you sleep at night. So Krishna loves that living entity. And this is one way we can become free of offenses. I personally found this very helpful. That when people annoy me, do people ever annoy you? Or am I the only one that people annoy? So when people annoy us, to just say, Krishna loves this person. Krishna loves this person. Krishna loves this person unlimitedly. And then immediately I feel some affection for that person. Immediately. Oh, Krishna loves. Oh, okay. Then it's all right. You see this sometimes even in families. We were talking the other day about how sometimes families like Sati and Shiva, they reject their child if their child marries someone they don't like. But if your child falls in love with someone you don't like, usually after some time you accept that person. Okay, they're my son-in-law, they're my daughter-in-law, what can I do? My son loves this girl, okay. My daughter loves this girl. So Krishna love, because I love my daughter who she loves, I also love. Because I love my son who he loves, I also love. So because I love Krishna and Krishna loves this person, all right, then I also have affection for them. Why would I want to offend them? Another really critical point, it's funny, George Bernard Shaw said this about meat eating. He said, how can we ask God to show us mercy if we're not merciful? So first reason we don't want to offend other devotees is that we'll really upset Krishna. Another reason we don't want to offend devotees is that we'll suffer. We may end up being killed in a forest fire. We'll get some reaction. Another reason is how can we expect Krishna to show, how can Krishna show me mercy if I'm not merciful? Jesus tells this story of the man who went to the judge. He was in debt. In those days, if you owed money, you often had to go to prison. And you work in the prison till you pay back your debts. Nowadays, everybody owes debt, and just normal. No, even there, they'll have advertisements. How to declare bankruptcy. You understand what's bankruptcy? Okay, I'm not going to pay my debts. People plan like this. I've met people. I've met even some devotees who will plan, okay, I'll get... I hope you're not listening to this class somewhere. I've met some devotees who will get, you know, 15 credit cards, borrow all the money from the credit cards for service, and then just not pay and say, okay, I won't pay. I'll just declare bankruptcy. So, but in those days, it was a crime. You would go to jail if you couldn't pay your debts. So this man was in front of a judge. And then he said, I've had this hardship and this hardship. So many things have happened. I tried to pay my debts. I couldn't pay my debts. And the judge said, okay, we'll excuse you. We'll wipe it clean. And then he goes out on the street, and someone who owed money to him walked by. And he said to this man, hey, you owe me money. And somebody saw this. They went back to the judge. And they said, he's demanding the repayment of the debt to him. The judge said, call him back. He said, okay, now you go to jail. So we want Krishna to be kind to us. I remember a devotee one time asking, why isn't everything fair? I said, if everything was fair, we would never get out of the material world. Our karma is so complicated. It's like a banyan tree. Now, sometimes people go to therapy to try to solve their problems. And therapy can be useful. But if you're really going to go to therapy, then you have to look at your past lives, and then the past lives of that, the past lives of that. You go back 50 lives, 100 lives, and you try to untangle all of the karma. Just like sometimes there's some string that's tangled, right? And you're working with it for hours and hours and hours. So our sojourn in this material world is like that. It's like, how many of you have seen a banyan tree? How many of you have seen? So at least you've seen photos. So a big banyan tree, you can't decide where it begins and where it ends. I spend time in Hawaii, or as I say, Hawaii. And there's many big banyan trees there. And you can't tell, because the branches send down new roots. And after some time, you can't tell what is the original trunk. I haven't seen it, but I've heard that in Calcutta, in the botanical gardens, there's a big banyan tree. And they've offered a reward to anyone who can identify the original trunk. And no one has been able to win the award. So our material entanglement is like that. It's a mess. You know, if you try to fix everything in the material world, you'll be here for a very, 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 very long time. So we want Krishna to show us mercy. We want him to excuse it. You know the story of Alexander the Great? You all know that story of Alexander with the Gordian knot? So there was this knot, rope tied in a knot, and they said anyone who can untie this knot, he can conquer the world. So Alexander the Great wanted to conquer the world, and he goes to try to, and he couldn't, so he took his sword, right, cut it. So that's what we need, just what Maharaj was speaking about this morning, Ridyantasa Bhadrani. Within our heart, there's so much. One devotee was just saying to me, we don't want to see all these abhadra because then we're afraid we'll get depressed. It really is depressing. If we could see all of the sinful activities we've done for so many lifetimes, everyone we've offended, the burden, it's so great. We can't imagine how great is that burden. All the living entities we've offended, just even in the last week probably, what to speak of in this lifetime or other lifetimes, anyone who suffered any pain because of some action that I've done. No? And I want mercy. I want mercy from other people. I want the people I've offended to excuse me. And I want Krishna to excuse me. I want Krishna to say, okay, Aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha yishyami masucha. I'll free you from that. It's okay. You don't have to pay back all your debts. You know, it's all right. We'll just wipe it clean. Let's go. Let's get out of jail. Forget it. All the crimes you've done. I'm looking for mercy, so I have to be merciful. How do I have any standing to ask Krishna for mercy unless I'm merciful? Impossible. If I'm not willing to forgive others, if I'm not willing to see the good in others, we talked the other day about the levels of fault finding and the levels of good finding. Remember the four levels? The honey finders and the fault finders? So I want Krishna to see the honey in me. I want Krishna to see the good. There's not much. I'm like a thorn bush that produces a little teeny, 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 tiny, tiny, tiny flower that stinks. There's not much good there. Not much good. Practically nothing. Even the good I do is all contaminated. All the service I do is because I'm thinking if I do some service, they'll give me some prasadam. If I do some service, they'll give me a room where there's hot water from my bath. If I do some service, then they'll say, Ormila, you're such a great devotee, like Marsh was talking about, and I'll think, yes, I am good. What's my motive? All my motives are rotten. What service do I do that's motivated just by love? Nothing. Still, I want Krishna to see some good in me. Right? I want Krishna to say, there's some good in that soul. Let me deliver her. I have a little hope. Sometimes I have a little hope. I know he's going to deliver me. I just know it. I don't know why, but somehow, just somehow he will. So how can I have that hope if I'm not that kind to others? If I don't see the good in others, if I mistreat others, if Krishna treated me the way I deserve to be treated, then I would be just a cockroach. Forever. I know, no hope. No hope. So that is another reason to be kind to others. Another reason to be kind to others. It's a really nice quote now from the Skanda Purana. How is it possible to, what are the different ways that we can offend devotees? So the Skanda Purana lists six improper dealings with God's devotees that obstruct one's chanting. To kill a devotee. Okay, that's pretty simple. Anybody ever killed a devotee? Hopefully none of us have killed a devotee. To blaspheme a devotee. So blaspheming can mean I say something about you that's not true. I find a fault where there's no fault. Or I exaggerate a fault. To envy a devotee. Now, why is that devotee getting the Mahaprasadam and I'm not? Why are they praising that devotee and they're not praising me? Or as Prabhupada says, you know, you hear that your old friend became a high court judge and you say, no, no, it's not possible. No, really, he's a high court judge. Well, then he's not getting a salary. So, you know, we say, oh, that devotee, he's not, can't really be doing that service. No, he's really doing that service. Well, they must be ill-motivated. He must be doing it for some other reason. To get angry at a devotee. So I don't think any of us have killed a devotee. Have we gotten angry at a devotee? To fail to offer respects or obeisances to a devotee. And then this one, to not feel joy upon seeing a devotee. Oh, there's so-and-so does. Oh, God. Now it's explained by Bhaktivinoda Thakur and also by Srila Prabhupada that this doesn't just apply to the other members of our own sampradaya. It extends to anyone who worships God. And we're going to look at this for a minute, because when Srila Prabhupada listed the 10 offenses, Sometimes he would explain, that means don't blaspheme Jesus or Muhammad. Don't think, oh, this is somebody from another group, just let me blaspheme them. So anybody who's worshiping God, anyone who one time says the name of God, we should feel joyful. Here's somebody who's worshiping God. On any level. We'll discuss this more in a minute. Some of these interactions involve our bodies, some of them involve our words, and others involve our attitudes. So some of these are offenses on the level of body, and we know from the story of Bhrigu Muni, the bodily offenses are the worst. So if I punch you, that's a worse offense than if I insult you, which is a worse offense than if I envy you. Or if I just think, oh, there's Krishna Das again. Yeah. So worst is physical. But all of those are offenses to devotees. Now, if we think about practitioners of other religions, so there's an or say even people in our own circle who we can see are beginners in Krishna consciousness. They're functioning at a lower level. Like Rupa Goswami says, we should discern who's at a higher level, who's at our level, who's at a lower level. Of course, if you're very advanced, you think that you're at the lowest level and everyone is above you. But if you're not genuinely thinking that way, so you'll see someone at a lower level. So how to see them? And I've understood this, we'll look at it from two angles. First angle is that truth is truth. Prabhupada gives this example many times. Mathematics is mathematics. Many universities are teaching mathematics. And mathematics is also taught for very little children. 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, they're learning 1 + 1 = 2. So mathematics is mathematics, but people may be learning at different levels. So in other religious systems, people are still learning to love God, but they may be learning at a very low level. But it's still love of God. You cannot say it's not love of God. Of course, there are some false schools. There are some fakes. There are some things that are not genuine religions. And then even within a low school, like sometimes in a primary school, there is one student who understands mathematics at a very high level. This happens, right? Sometimes 10-year-old child can do mathematics at a PhD level. And sometimes people in the universities, they're just going to parties. So we can say we have the highest system, but it's not that everybody in ISKCON is functioning at the highest level. And it's not that everybody in some other system is functioning at the lowest level. So there very well may be some people in other systems of religion who are more realized than some people in ISKCON. Is that possible? So we look at the level, and we also look at the individual. Now, one symptom of being at a very low level, the Kanista Adhikari, is they think God is only in the temple. They don't know how to deal with other living entities. So if we're worshiping Krishna, but we're cruel to other living entities, then Lord Kapila Dev says that instead of putting our grains into the fire, where are we throwing our grains? Into? Ashes. We're throwing our grains into ashes. So we very much like to criticize people who say they're religious and then they kill people of other religions. You know, in the name of God, I'm going to blow up this building. In the name of God, I'm going to shoot the people from another religion. You know, the Shiite Muslims are shooting the Sunni Muslims, and the Protestants are shooting the Catholics, and the Muslims are shooting the Jews, or whatever. And this is very low level of religion, the lowest level of Kanista Adhikari. So we should not be like that. We should not, in the name of religion. And I've met people even in the Hare Krishna movement. I met one who told me, my service to Prabhupada is to destroy ISKCON. I just didn't know what to say. I've met many people who think, you know, my service to Prabhupada, my service to Krishna is to criticize as many devotees as possible. And they create websites, and they have, you know, electronic groups, and they have meetings, and they get together, let's criticize devotees. In the name of justice, and in the name of service. So, this on a subtle level is not different from blowing up buildings. Same. It's not different from I don't like you, what you're doing, I will shoot you. So another reason we should not blaspheme devotees or offend devotees is that if we do, we stay on this Kanista platform. We can't advance. We're so busy throwing in the grains and we're throwing them into ashes. Everything we're doing, we're trying to light a fire with wet wood. Another reason not to blaspheme devotees or in any way offend devotees is given by Srila Prabhupada in the Nectar Devotion, chapter 18. He said, if it is seen that a person has developed a high standard of devotion without having undergone even the regulative principles, it is to be understood that his status of devotional service was achieved in a former life. For some reason or other, it has been temporarily stopped, most probably by an offense committed at the lotus feet of a devotee. Now, with a good second chance, it has begun again to develop. So I once asked, I was at a New Vrindavan at our Festival of Inspiration, and about 300 devotees, and I asked them, how many of you think that there was a good chance you had some connection with Krishna consciousness in a previous life? And 90% of them raised their hands. I'm going to ask you here, how many of you think there's a really good chance you had some connection with Krishna consciousness in a previous life? So Prabhupada here is giving one reason why we're still here. And he says, particularly in this connection, in Nectar Devotion, right after this quote, he says, if you offend a devotee, you may take birth in a low family. So there's a good chance that, at least for many of us, that the reason we took another birth and the reason we took birth in families that were not so pious is that we offended a devotee. So we can ask, do I really want to do that again? Do I really want to do that again? Do I want my devotional service to be impeded? Again I take birth in some low family because I've offended the devotees. Taking birth in a low family means you're moved away from the association of devotees for a while, doesn't it? It's like the child, they're hitting the other children. Okay, now you go sit in the corner. If you don't know how to play nicely, then you can't play for now until you decide you're going to play nice. We see this also in this life. I've seen many times that devotees who offend other devotees, Krishna pushes them away. Okay. And they'll come to you and say, I found this great house to live. It's wonderful. Oh, where is it? Oh, it's about a 6-hour drive from the temple. Right. I've seen this, that somehow they're pushed away. They're off in some corner somewhere. And Krishna's saying, better you don't play right now until you can play nicely. And of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu compares offending a devotee to what creature? A mad elephant. So I'm going to give you a little biology lesson now. You have to excuse me. As I say, I was a Gurukul teacher for 27 years. So I was studying things about science and history and geography. And so the elephants are very peculiar in many ways, of course. Elephants are the only creature that has a trunk. But, you know, in most species of life, the female of the species goes into what they call heat, where periodically she's able to have a child. And generally, the male of the species is not like that. Generally, the male of the species, their fertility is constant. Now, elephants are very peculiar. Male elephants, they're always fertile, but they have some time period where they go into a period of madness. And the zoologists have speculated that this allows some of the younger males to produce children, because otherwise the way the elephants work, like many animal societies, just the big old elephant has many, many females and produces all of the children. But when a male elephant gets into this madness, he has all kinds of physical symptoms. Actually, liquid starts oozing from his forehead. And if he was a trained elephant, he forgets all of his training. No mahout can control this elephant. And often after the madness passes, they have to train him all over again. And the mad elephant will just, even the big old elephants will get out of his way. If he wants to go mate, they just stay out of his way. This is a mad elephant. So that's what we mean by a mad elephant. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was speaking in a society where people regularly saw these mad elephants. And elephants, they don't usually castrate elephants. Like with bulls and horses, if they want to work with the animals, generally they castrate them, so they're easier to work. You don't do that with elephants because their anatomy is complicated and it requires a very difficult procedure. So they usually leave the male elephants. But that means that the male elephants, occasionally they go completely crazy. And anything that's in their path doesn't matter. The biggest adversary, bull elephant, they just try, and everybody just gets out of there. Let them do whatever they want. Right? They'll kill even their favorite handler. Normally elephants are very affectionate and very caring, and they have a nice relationship with their handler, but they become unmanageable. So an offense against a devotee is like that. It's like when the male elephant goes crazy, and it destroys everything. Everything. We've taken so much time to have this nice garden, so much care we've taken. I'm going to chant my rounds every day. I'm going to chant my Gayatri. I'm going to worship my deity with devotion. I'm going to read the books. I'm going to go out on book distribution. I'm going to go on Harinam. I'm going to follow all the rules. I'm going to take bath, be very clean. Only eat first-class prasadam that's cooked by the best brahmanas, offered to the deities at regulated times with devotion and tulsi. I'm going to say all the prayers, learn all the slokas, and we have this beautiful, beautiful garden, and then we let this crazy elephant trample it all to pieces. So how foolish. How foolish. What gardener would allow a mad elephant to go through their garden? So how seriously we should take it. So what to do about this problem? What to do about this problem? So first of all, avoid other people who are blasphemous and envious. Avoid other fault fighters. Offer your respect to them. If they're devotees, don't associate with them. I have seen very nice devotees become habitual offenders by associating with other offenders. I've seen this many times. Because we all have this tendency to fault find. Anybody is free from the tendency to fault find? Rupa Goswami says, if you're free from this tendency to fault find, then you're an Uttamadhikari. I also have always found this interesting, that Rupa Goswami giving the symptoms for Kanista, Majjhima, Uttama. For Uttama, he gives only two. What are the two?
Engage in unalloyed service.
Unalloyed service. And devoid of the propensity to criticize. Only 26 qualities of a devotee. Why did he pick that one? Why didn't he say undeviated devotional service and poetic? Undeviated devotional service and expert. Undeviated devotional service and not attached to material possessiveness. He could have picked so many qualities. Right, when Krishna is listing the qualities of devotees in the 12th chapter, he mostly lists being equipoised. Rupa Goswami was one. Free from the propensity to criticize others. Not just free from criticizing others, free from the propensity to criticize others. Doesn't even happen in the mind, doesn't even happen in the heart. So if you see people who are actively critical, who think their service to Krishna is criticism, do we all know people like this? Maybe we ourselves are like this. My service to Krishna is to criticize devotees. Sometimes they even create whole newspapers. The Criticizing Devotees newspaper. So offer respects from a distance. Don't become the intimate friend of such people. Right? Now you can say, but sometimes I need to point out some fault. But fact, Vinod Thakur says is that the teacher has to say, this is right and this is wrong. What are you going to do? You have to say, this is right, this is wrong. You have to say, stealing is wrong. Oh, Krishna Das stole something. Well, stealing is wrong. You don't just say, oh, nice, nice, Krishna Das, it's okay if you steal. We don't want to find any fault in you. It's all right. But without malice, without envy. And see what our position is. It's not our position to point out everybody's fault. Who do we have to point out faults in? We have, yes?
Our children and disciples.
To children and disciples. You must.
Must.
You can't just say to your child, oh, my dear child, did you hit your brother on the head with the toy fire truck? How sweet. Your child will become a criminal. Even Mother Yasoda is chastising Krishna. She's worried that if she doesn't chastise Krishna, he'll grow up to be a thief. She's actually worried. My little son, I don't want him to be a criminal. Don't steal, Krishna. She says this thing. Stop your stealing. Stop eating dirt. Let me see if you ate dirt. Open your mouth. But with affection. The parents should correct their children with affection, out of love, not out of envy. If you have a student, you have a disciple, anyone who's your subordinate, who you're responsible to train. But we're not responsible to train the whole world. Do you know who we really like to point out faults in? What kind of people do we really like to point out faults in?
People like us.
Superiors. Really like to point out faults in superiors. If you take a role of authority in ISKCON, you know what comes with the job?
Criticism.
You get there's a special t-shirt that we give to anybody who gets a title in ISKCON of authority. And it has a big target painted on the front and another one painted on the back with a little sign, please shoot me. It's very typical that we want to find fault. Why do we particularly like to find fault in our authorities? Women are very critical of their husbands. Children are very critical of their parents. In whatever community we're in, we're very critical of our temple president, of our GBC. People after the first couple years of, oh, Gurudev, they become very critical of their guru. Why do we do that?
Because they're full of fault.
There we go. Why do we... Okay, thank you. End of the class. Why do we have such a strong tendency to criticize our superiors? Yes,
well, in one way, it's like original sin, because we're criticizing Krishna, who left him. So it's like
all authorities represent God to some extent. So because they represent God, it's an indirect way of our criticizing God. I've also thought that we usually see our authorities as the gatekeepers of our sense gratification. That the reason I'm not getting all the enjoyment that I want is that this person is stopping it. And we see anyone who has power over our life, if this person has power over my life, then it's their fault that I'm not getting everything I want in life. It's their fault. If only this person would do what I want, then I'd get the life that I want. We see them. Like, when you go on a road, like you go to Croatia because you leave the EU, immediately there's stop, where's your passport, who are you, where are you going? So there's certain people in our life that we see like that. We see they're like the passport control. I can't get into England or I can't get into Croatia without saying something to this person. If I say the wrong thing, then they won't stamp my passport. And we think the person who's going to get it's this person. This is why there's often so much anger and criticism in a family. Because we're thinking, you know, if only my wife acted like this, then I would be happy. If only my husband acted like this, then I would be happy. It's often why people get so frustrated with their children. If only my children acted like this, then I would be happy. But especially the gatekeepers. This person has power over me. The reason I can't get what I want is they're not allowing it. And we think this way about our spiritual life too. The reason I'm not Krishna conscious is because that person who has authority over me is not letting me be Krishna conscious. They're not letting me go to the festival. They're not letting me do the service I want. They're telling me, you know, they won't sit down and meet Bhagavatam with me. And one way we respond to this is by finding fault with them. Because if I find fault with them, then... what? Then it's definitely not my fault. It's already not my fault. It's already all their fault. It's already their fault. I can justify my whimsical actions. And I can, ultimately, get rid of them. Why should I have this person as my authority if they're full of faults? I have to follow this person. Ultimately, I'm following them voluntarily. I've given them power over me. And if they're full of faults, well, I don't have to give them power over me anymore. And then I'll have no block to my enjoyment in the world. Or I'll have no block to my Krishna consciousness. Then I'll just be able to become Krishna conscious. Just throw all the GBC, we're talking about sending all the women to Australia, send all the GBC and all the temple presidents to Australia, and then we'll all become Krishna conscious.
I'll give you the address, you can send the ticket to.
Actually, Australia's a nice place. We often think like that. You know, it's this person's fault, and the way I can get rid of them is to criticize them. Then at least I can justify my rebellion. And ultimately, my dear friends, we do this, of course, with Krishna. The transcendental autocrat. Oh, he's an autocrat. We don't like autocrats. Autocrats mean like Stalin, Hitler, transcendental autocrat. Ugh. Why should I listen to him? Okay. Look how many faults he has. If he were really a nice God, he wouldn't have let me break my foot. If he was really a nice God, he wouldn't have given me this lousy wife. If he was really a nice God, he would have given me a better body, and so forth. He's not really a good God. This is what the demons do, right? They criticized him. Oh, we don't know what family he's born in. He doesn't really have any caste. He did this, he did that. So why do I have to listen to him? I give the dog a bad name and hang it. This is when they don't have to follow the Shastra. Sometimes devotees say, well, Urmila, why do you think I should do that? I said, well, because it's in the Shastra. It's a good reason. That's what it says in the Shastra. It's what Krishna says. That's what Prabhupada says. I don't know if I can follow the Shastra. I mean, maybe Krishna didn't know about my situation. Maybe he's not really very clever. Maybe there's something wrong with him. Maybe he just didn't understand my Prarabdha Karma. Why I have to do this. So this is our tendency for fault finding. So one way we can get rid of our fault finding and blaspheming tendency is to see, why am I doing it? Why am I doing it? Because I'm so afraid that I'm not going to get what I need and I'm not going to get what I want. And this person is standing in the way. And therefore, I don't have the power to destroy them, but I have the power to try to shoot them full of holes. Right? I'm going to read you a couple of things now that are a little heavy. Sridhar Maharaj, the Bhagavatam commentator Sridhar Maharaj. We have at least three Sridhar Swamis, right? We have the historical commentator, Prabhupada's godbrother, and my godbrother. He wrote, whether the words are true or not, pointing out the faults of a Vaishnava constitutes blasphemy.
Can you repeat?
Yes, I will. Whether the words are true or not, pointing out the faults of a Vaishnava constitutes blasphemy. But Urmila Prabhupada says in his purport that calling a thief is not fault finding. Why do you think Sridhar Swami says this? That even if it's true. Krishna says he's still the same. And we already talked about sometimes you have to point out faults, right? Your child, your disciple, or sometimes in management, like what was brought up this morning. Sometimes there has to be a management decision that you say, hey, this person stole 5,000 euros out of the temple treasury. I don't think running the treasury is a good service for him. Sometimes there have to be management decisions like that. That's practical. Like we had one devotee who was very violent. And four times he'd been thrown out of the temple for violence. And then we had a new temple president and he said, oh, but he's sorry. I said, Prabhu, he's already attacked so many people. Let him practice Krishna consciousness at home. And he said, no, let him leave. And again he attacked. So sometimes there may have to be something practical. But in general, pointing out the fault, if you're management, if you're a manager, or if you're a parent, but why should we not point out even true faults?
Because it's not eternal fault, and if he's continuing to practice,
then the faults are going
to go away. And if we're not that person's mother or father or guru or manager, what is our purpose for pointing out the fault? Why are we doing it? If I'm not in a position to help that person, and guru may be temporary also, just like someone may come to you and ask for advice and take a role of your student for that 10 minutes, and you may have to say, my dear Prabhu, this thing you're doing is not good. They've taken that role as your student. But if someone's not in the role of your student and you're not a manager, what is the purpose for pointing out the fault? So therefore, that is not even allowed. I'd also like to read something I found very encouraging. This is written by a Christian monk, Thomas A. Kempis, in the 13th century. He wrote a book called Imitation of Christ, which is many sections of it are quite wonderful. But this section I found particularly helpful. He says, try to bear patiently with the defects and infirmities of others, whatever they may be, because you also have many a fault which others must endure. So, you know, I tend to take my own faults very lightly. I tend to think my own faults are not very serious and they don't cause a lot of pain and trouble to others and they're far outweighed by my unlimited good qualities. But really, my faults do cause pain to others and sometimes they tell me about it. And the people who deal with me on a regular basis, they have to regularly suffer some sort of inconvenience and difficulty and even pain because of my faults. If you cannot make yourself what you wish to be, if you cannot make yourself what you wish to be, so even we see some of our own faults and we have tried, and we have tried, and we have tried to fix them. And we have failed, and we have failed, and we have failed, and we have failed. And we think, all right, now I fix that fault. It's done. It's finished. And again we do it, isn't it? And again we're embarrassed. Someone says, you just did it again.
And
I thought I had fixed it. If we cannot, if you cannot make yourself what you wish to be, how can you bend others to your will? I want to force you to be perfect. I'm trying to force you to be perfect. I can't force myself to be perfect. I've tried, and I fail. We want them to be perfect, yet we do not correct our own faults. We wish them to be severely corrected, yet we will not correct ourselves. Their great freedom displeases us, yet we will not be denied what we ask. I'm saying, why is this person allowed to go around offending people and having this problem and that? Why isn't he punished? Why doesn't the law of karma come on his head today? Why doesn't the GBC throw him out? But if someone says, okay, I want you to be punished for your wrongs, no, no. I should be forgiven. I should be free. We would have them bound by laws, yet we allow ourselves to be restrained in nothing. So I want that person, I want them to get justice. I want them to get karma. I want it to be fair for them. For me, I want mercy. I don't want it fair for me. I want it fair for you. I don't want it fair for me. I want you to pay for everything. I want you to admit everything. I want you to ask forgiveness for everything. I want you to suffer life after life after life for how you insulted me. For me, I want mercy. Hence, it is clear how seldom we think of others as we do of ourselves. So we'll end with just a few minutes on how to do the opposite and how to appreciate. So everyone wants to be appreciated. Everyone's hankering for appreciation because in Vaikuntha, everyone appreciates everybody. It's wonderful purports in the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada talks about Bhagavatam. Sukadeva Goswami's talking about all the beautiful flowers, scented flowers, are appreciating the fragrance of Tulsi. So for a materially conditioned soul, Tulsi doesn't have much fragrance. You'd buy gardenias or... But they're appreciating Tulsi. The birds are appreciating the bees. So again, from our perspective, the birds have sweet songs and the bees are just annoying. But the birds stop their singing to hear the bees. And everyone is appreciating. So many letters and purports, Prabhupada talks about appreciating the other devotees. Now, we often appreciate devotees after they're not on this planet anymore. We're very good at that. We have a memorial service and everybody gets up and says, oh, I had so much appreciation. And somehow, during their life, we never say anything. So my mother was talking about money, but she said, it's better to give your money with a warm hand than with a cold hand. Better to give your money away when you're alive. So better to give our appreciation when the person can't hear it. Right, Maharaj was talking about how people want to stay as ghosts over the graveyard because that's the only time they get appreciated is at their funeral. So all the wonderful things we say about people, I've started a habit of doing that on people's birthdays. So now with the internet, it's very easy to know when people's birthdays are. If you use Skype or Facebook, you get a notice of somebody's birthday. So especially people that I work with regularly. You know, I try to write some appreciation every year on their birthday to the group. Oh, I'd like to appreciate so-and-so Das or so-and-so Devi Dasi. So take the time to appreciate. Now, what's the best kind of appreciation? Often when we appreciate people, we appreciate them generally, and when we criticize them specifically. I say, oh, Prabhu, you're so sincere. But look, you left your sock over there and you did this. So reverse it, you know. Take that specific and do it for the appreciation. If I just say to you, oh, you know, Prema Gopi, you're so sincere, you're so devoted, you're so responsible. Do you like that? No. It's actually not pleasing. When people appreciate us like that, we tend to feel that it's flattery. And it usually is. And also our mind says, well, she doesn't know I'm really not so sincere and I'm really not so responsible and I'm really not so devoted. But if I say, you know, Prema Gopi, you've been taking care of my washing every day, even though I wanted to do it myself, and that's allowed me more time to prepare for my classes, and it's allowed me more time to work on the project, and you always make sure I get fed, even when I'm in the middle of something and I forgot all about it, and you've been helping me worship my Govardhan deity every day, you've been bringing the fruits, and you brought those fresh fruits from the farm, and you brought the flowers, and I don't have to be in any anxiety, I just know there's the fruits and flowers every day for my worship, and it's made my life so much easier, and I've been feeling so grateful and so happy with everything you're doing. And I also been feeling so grateful to Prabhupada that he gave me a society in which I can have people like you. A very specific. By the way, it's almost impossible to appreciate someone specifically and not be genuine. It's very hard to give specific appreciation in a manipulative fashion. I'm sure you could if you really worked at it. You know, if you really tried to separate your heart from your head, you could probably do it. But it's very difficult. It's very easy to give general praise without being genuine. Oh, you're so nice. That's easy. I don't have to mean it. In order to give specific appreciation, the first thing I need to do is I need to observe. I need to observe. I need to notice. So just like those devotees who are now in the kitchen. So everyone else is sitting in the class. Everyone else is going to the kirtan. And you're in the kitchen. And it probably isn't a perfect kitchen. It probably isn't just like your kitchen at home. You know, it's in a little cabin. I'm sure not everything works exactly the way you want it to work. And when you're in a strange kitchen, you don't really know where everything is. I know when I go into a strange kitchen, it takes me at least an hour just to figure out where everything is. And the kind of things I can cook in my own kitchen in 10 minutes takes me 2 hours in a strange kitchen. Where do I find the mortar and pestle? And I'm sure in this kitchen here, you don't even have all your supplies. You know, when it's at a camp, you can't remember to bring everything. And you can't bring everything. And some of the equipment you want to use probably isn't there. And you have to figure out, okay, how do I prepare this without the equipment? Then you're cooking for all these people. You know, it's one thing to cook for 5 people or 10 people. It's a whole other thing to cook for dozens of people or hundreds of people. It's much more difficult to figure out the spicing, right, to make sure everything's cooked properly. Especially rice, very hard to cook large quantities of rice and have it turn out right. And then everyone is expecting that it's going to be done on time, you know, and if it's not done on time, then the seminars can't go on, and you may have difficulty finding your ingredients. Then you're having to cook early in the morning and late in the evening, and what's there around here in the morning and the evening?
Mosquitoes.
Right? And then during the day it gets hot, and the fires are hot, and you're there sweating and perspiring. And everyone's sitting eating the prasadam, and nobody stops in and says, wow, thank you very much. So the speakers get garlands, and the speakers get a place to stay with a hot water heater, and you're just staying in the tent. Even though without the prasadam, there's no festival. Without the prasadam, there's no festival. Or if the prasadam's not nice, people aren't going to come back to the festival the next year. No matter how nice the seminars are, right? Even if you have really wonderful and enlivening seminars and wonderful kirtans, still, you know, if the potatoes aren't cooked, if the rice is mushy, if there's no salt in the sabji, if the chapatis are like rocks, they'll say, you know, nice Krishna katha, but you had to bring your own prasadam. It's the heart of the festival. So that's how you appreciate. You look at the jagya. If we think about how I want to be appreciated, the things for which I like to be appreciated are the things practically nobody ever even notices. You know, like you asked me, how long does it take to prepare for a seminar? People don't usually notice the underneath things. The phone calls you made, the time you had to drive for hours and hours in the rain, the crises that you had to deal with, the tent blowing over right before the seminar was supposed to be there. You know, the fights the two devotees got into right before something was supposed to happen and you had to solve it. And you had to solve it and make everybody happy. Or you were sick, you had a fever, and you couldn't even think straight. But the Rath Yatra was going to start in an hour. And you had to be there. And nobody notices those things. Nobody notices those kind of things. People just look at the external result. Of course, Krishna notices. So if you can start to notice those things in other people, start to pay attention to that. What are the sacrifices they're making? And as specific as possible. I see, my dear wife, that you went out shopping today even though you weren't feeling well. And I noticed that you bought my favorite fruit even though it wasn't at the regular store and you had to go to a different shop to get it. I noticed that you cooked the meal on time even though we ran out of gas and you had to call the new person to come. Those sort of things. Notice people. So this means you have to pay attention. But mostly we're paying attention. Who are we paying attention to usually? Myself. I'm focused on my sacrifices and my tapasya. And I'm hoping, like you're saying, you want. I'm so funny when you said people are waiting for you to appreciate their shirt. They're just waiting. When is someone going to appreciate my shirt or my hairstyle? And they're so grateful if someone says, wow. Right? And I'm walking around thinking, when is somebody going to appreciate me and what I've done? I'll start noticing the other devotees. Now, this is a spiritual world. It's a spiritual world. Spiritual world isn't just a place. It's not like, okay, well, now I'm in Maya because I'm here. And when the airplane comes and takes me there, then I'll be Krishna conscious. I just got to move myself geographically. The whole problem is I'm in the wrong geographic location. That's my problem. Yeah. And one can live in Vaikuntha here. This is also Krishna's realm. Maya is really just a veil over our consciousness. And this veil is a veil of envy. And we can remove this envy by appreciation. It's the antidote to envy and fault finding is appreciation. So this is something that we need to cultivate. It's not a pill you take. You don't take the appreciation pill and then you become appreciative. And I'm going to give you a final reason to be appreciative of other devotees. I've given you many, and we could say negative reasons. I'm going to give a positive reason. The law of karma works positively too. If we would like to be appreciated, and everybody wants to be appreciated. If we want to be appreciated, guess how you do it. Give it. Of course, what's very nice is when you appreciate Krishna's devotees, even if you do it because you want to be appreciated. Or because you don't want a mad elephant to run in your garden, or because you don't want to take birth in a low family next life, or because you'd like to be able to relish the sweetness of the holy name. You know what happens when we appreciate devotees? Krishna gets so pleased. So pleased. And he reciprocates. Now, the person who asks, how do I know that God respects me? If you want to feel Krishna's appreciation, would we like to feel that? We'd like to feel? I mean, we're happy if some stranger on the street says, wow, what a shirt. Some stranger, and we'll give them a $20 donation for the book. Just because they complimented our shirt. How much more do we want our friends to appreciate us? How much more do we want our family to appreciate us? How wonderful would it be if we could feel Krishna appreciating us? Like Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati said, don't try to see Krishna act in such a way that Krishna will see you. Imagine Krishna says, hey, come on. Hey, I want to see you. Yeah. Hey, I noticed what you did. I noticed that day you got up at 3:30 in the morning even though you had a fever. And you still went in the kitchen and you still did your service because there was no one else to do it because everyone else was in India and you wanted me to have something to eat. I saw that. Nobody else saw it, but I saw it. I saw when those people insulted you and you just smiled and said, thank you for correcting me, Prabhu, even though your heart was burning. I saw that. Thank you. Would you like to feel Krishna's appreciation? And Krishna says, well done, my good and faithful servant. Thank you. So, if we appreciate the other devotees, then we will feel that appreciation from Krishna. Fastest way to connect with Krishna is to appreciate his devotees. It doesn't really cost that much. It's not a high price. Just to start paying attention to the people around you, what are they doing, and to express appreciation. At least once in a month, maybe. At least on people's birthday. At least when you see that people are struggling. At least sometimes. Not to wait until they're out of their body. And then you do it because you're obligated at the funeral service. So then, rather than having a mad elephant trample our garden, then it will be an enthusiastic elephant that pulls the logs out of our heart and does good work for us so we can build a nice temple in our heart, Mana Mana Mandire, Raha Nisidin. We can ask Krishna, please stay in this temple of my heart day and night because we've cleaned it. Right? We've cleaned it of even the small dust and dirt of envy. So thank you very much. I apologize that I wasn't nearly as entertaining as Maharaj this morning. There was after that, I thought I was embarrassed to speak after that. I thought, well, there's no way that I could top that in a million years. So thank you for coming. I hope I've done some service. We could take maybe questions, just 2 or 3 minutes, and we need a break before the next seminar. Yes. To hear.
What I'm proper to say or
That's a very good question. I think it depends on the circumstances. If someone's coming to you with their problems and you find that their mood is just a critical, envious, fault-finding mood and you cannot help them, then you just leave. If you can help them, depends how open they are to helping to your helping them, then maybe you can help them come to another position. Now you have to see, can I help this person? Can I not help this person? Is this affecting me? Is it not affecting me? Because sometimes when I'm helping people, I have to listen to their thinking that this other person is the fault of their problem. That's very common. People will come, oh, my husband's doing this, my guru's doing this, my town president's doing this, my boss at work is doing this, my child is doing this. But you have to see what is their mood and to what extent can I... If I can help that person to come to another platform, but if I can't, then I respect you as you're chanting Hare Krishna. You have to be careful. I mean, wasn't Jayananda wouldn't hear any criticism, right? He would just walk away. There's one devotee like that in Chaitanya Charitamrita also.
Dosha Darshani is the pujari for the Madan Mohan, well, the temple where Krishnadas
Kaviraj got the garland.
Went, and he, in order to have his, he prayed to the deity that made. Should I write the Chaitanya Charitamrita and the garland fell off the deity? And the devotee who was the pujari there was known as the Dosha Darshani because he never saw faults in anything.
Never saw, and he wouldn't hear any faults. I think there's a few other examples also of certain devotees who, if there were anybody was. Raghunath Das. That if anybody were criticizing a devotee, he would just walk away. It depends. I mean, if you're in the mood of if you have the role of a counselor and a manager, sometimes you have to hear these things. Or the people who work in ISKCON Resolve and they have to hear both sides of the argument. But you do have to be careful. I mean, I know of one devotee, one former devotee, who had training in dealing with child abuse. She was a counselor who worked out in the world dealing with cases of child sexual abuse and physical abuse and neglect. That was her job. She worked for the government. So as soon as she joined ISKCON, everybody got very excited and said, oh, here's somebody that can help with these problems in ISKCON. So she started being the main person, and she couldn't take it anymore after that, because she was having to hear about just horrible things. So you have to be careful. You know, if you have some, if that's your role, if you're in the role, if you have a managerial role, right, you have to sometimes deal with this. This person said this, this person did this. If you're a counselor role, you may have to deal with it. And if you find it, I read an interesting article not too long ago about that some people have a job to get offensive material off of internet sites. You know, a lot of these, like, say, Facebook or MySpace or blogs, people will post things that are criminal or that are pornographic or that are racist or that are offensive. And you know how you can report it? Are you familiar with these things? You can make a report. Somebody's put up something. So somebody has to check those reports. And someone has to look at the material and get it off the internet. And all over the world, there's teams of people who do this. But in order to do this, they have to look at very disturbing things. They have to look at photographs of people being tortured and people being raped and that someone else is posting on the internet. And they said people can't do these jobs for very long. And they have to give them psychological counseling all the time because it's so much disturbing their mentality that they have to be exposed to these things. There's a wonderful letter where Prabhupada says that the highest principle is to save others, and higher than that is to save yourself. So, you know, you have to be honest. What can I do? What can I not do? Am I able to help this person and not be affected? Or am I not? What's my job? What's my position? And what can I do? But if a mad elephant is running, you just get out of the way. Even if you're the biggest, strongest patriarch elephant, when the young male elephant is in his madness, you get out of the way. Is that okay? Yes, try this one.
Maybe you could comment on that.
Yes.
Peter went way off, and then probably said two things. He said you should continue to follow the authority of your position subordinate. And then he said the second of command is
why you didn't do things. So I see that Tradesman was talking about a case that happened in one temple where the leader went way, and I mean really off. It wasn't a little off, it was really off. They were offering chicken to the deities. And Krishna didn't have me live in that temple while it was happening, although I was from that area. I joined in Chicago, and I moved to that temple right after it was finished. But I ended up moving into an apartment where the devotee who'd been there before, Gopal Krishna, when he was a householder, he had all those letters, copies of all the letters written to Prabhupada and copies of Prabhupada's responses. So I got to read about the whole story. I mean, devotees were being beaten. There was, you know, eggs and chicken in the deity's kitchen. The money from the temple was going for people's personal accounts. I mean, it was a really horrific situation. And Prabhupada was especially upset with the leaders and the managers that why they didn't complain, why they tolerated. It went on for about 2 years. Why they didn't do anything. And for the devotees in general, he says, you have to cooperate. So this goes back to what's my position? What am I responsible for? Am I Yamaraj? If I'm Yamaraj, then I have a duty to do. If I'm not Yamaraj, I don't. Of course, sometimes there may be an emergency. I mean, if a child's running in front of a car, you just grab the child, you don't think, oh, it's not my child. If someone's beating somebody in front of you, you don't say, well, it's, you know, I'm not the temple president. So, an emergency. But generally, we have to act according... What's our level of responsibility? But should always be without envy and without malice. Should never be with envy and malice. Never be fault-finding with envy or malice. Always with compassion and as a service. Okay, this if this is my service, if I'm the temple commander, if I'm the GBC, if I'm then this is my service to deal with this. If I'm the parent, if I'm the guru, if I'm the teacher, then that's my service. And I deal with it with compassion as Krishna's servant. And if I'm not, then you can certainly say something. You can certainly go to the authority and say, oh, by the way, there's a dead chicken in the kitchen. Who actually said something.
But I know other devotees who said something, but they didn't. They weren't allowed to stay in the temple.
Sometimes you just leave a situation. I mean, sometimes also, if there's a situation that you can't rectify, you're not in a position of authority, you just go on. And that may also be there. But I think the key principle is without envy. Without envy, without malice, without vengeance. To do our best to be appreciative, and if I have to be because of my position, because of the situation, should always be without envy and without malice. And don't assume I have no envy. Assume I have envy. Don't think, oh, okay, well, I never do anything out of envy. I'm doing this just for a service. Figure that probably my motive is envy. Probably my motive is fear, that I'm not going to get the sense gratification that I want, that I'm not going to get... Figure that. Assume that my reasons are bad first, and then really look. Why am I doing this? I found this person to be extremely helpful. Why am I doing this? Especially asking, what am I afraid of? What am I personally afraid of? Oh, okay. I'm afraid that this person is going to do something that's going to hurt me in some way. They're going to hurt my service. And my actions are coming from fear. Wait a minute. Okay, I don't need to do this. I don't need to write this. I don't need to say this. I don't need to get involved because Krishna's taking care of me. I found that to be extremely helpful. Just what's motivating me? And be honest. Said the truthful devotee, to be truthful with oneself and ask Krishna and be willing to hear the answer and wait. I knew of this one lady who would periodically write these really nasty letters to other devotees. Horrible. And we'd say to her, okay, write the letters, but don't send them. Just wait. We said, at least wait till your husband comes home and ask him if you should send it. Ask somebody else. Wait 24 hours. Just wait. Think about it. What's my motive? And she would never do that. Write it immediately. Put it in your mailbox. Hand it to you. So, you know, if you feel like, I've got to fix this thing. I must. Justice. Service! Justice! Stop. What am I afraid of? What's my position? Is this my responsibility? Is it someone else's responsibility? Should I just tell the responsible person? Take the time to think. And if you're convinced that you are the person who's responsible, it is your duty, and your motives are service, then without envy. All right, we need to stop now. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.